they were ready to stone her. Metaphorically, at least, because we were in an airport terminal, and the last time I checked, you couldn't bring rocks through TSA. But had there been any, they would have tried to use them on her. See, our flight was supposed to leave Atlanta at 6 a.m. and land here by 7:30 a.m. so that we could all make it to our offices by 9 a.m. on that Monday morning. But it was already 8:30 in Atlanta, and some folks who got to the airport early had been waiting for about 4 hours. The anger was visible, strong, and present. She came across the microphone and said, "Well, the plane that you are going to be leaving on should be here in about an hour. And then it'll take about 30 minutes for them to deplane, another 30 minutes for us to get on, 2 more hours added to the trip. Please make yourself comfortable," she said. "We'll do everything we can to get you on this plane as soon as possible and get you to your destination. We apologize for the delay. And please know, if there's anything that we can do to make this more bearable, we will do it. On behalf of American Airlines and our One World partners, we sincerely hope you understand." They didn't. And immediately as she put the phone down, they rushed her desk. They started demanding coffee and food, free flights and refunds, hotel change flights. And I watched her in the midst of it all, keep her cool, being polite to everyone, but also denying them their request. And when we finally boarded, I was one of the last ones to board because I used that time to catch up on some sleep that I had not gotten from the weekend. And I asked her, how is it that she could be so cool in the midst of such chaos and anger? She turned to me and said with a smile, "I've been a gate agent a long time, and I've been here before." In our scripture passage this morning, we meet Moses in a similar place. They are ready to stone him, but he's been here before. See, we're sort of taking you all on a roller coaster ride of sort with our lectionary passages. We've had to switch up things in the text to keep up with some important thematic Sundays, such as celebrating Cheryl next week and World Communion Sunday, so we've switched the lectionary around a bit. We've jumped ahead, and the Hebrews are already in the wilderness. We'll return next week to them journeying across the Red Sea and getting bread from heaven. But these stories that we will come back to, inform us about the context of our own story. As you remember, we're here in the Exodus account. And this story begins with the Hebrews fleeing into Egypt because there's famine in their land. God has already sent Joseph and put him in place as the prime minister. And so they stay there, they multiply, and they begin to add to the culture in this foreign land. But their presence, perhaps their browner presence, troubles their new countrymen and women, and their oppression begin. The Bible tells us that a king comes to power who did not know Joseph. A ruler came to power who did not understand the story of how those people got there, who forgot the generosity of the country that they were leading, forgot the values of inclusion and justice and compassion. A leader came to power who forgot their nation's story and what made their nation truly great. A leader came to power who did not respect the sermons of Martin or the songs of Coretta, who dismissed the activism of the dreamers and the plight of the black woman. A king came to power that did not know Joseph. And so for 400 years, they toiled and labored under slavery and harshness. But the Bible also says that God heard the cries of her people. And God approached Moses, that black man with a double consciousness, a two-ness, an Egyptian-ness and a Hebrew-ness, a Morehouse-ness and a Harvard-ness, a man who grew up in the hood but also could hang in the suburbs. God spoke to him and said, "Go, Moses, go tell Pharaoh to let my people go." And with some fear and resistance, Moses actually found the courage to do so, to speak to his own people, to his friends and his classmates, his neighbors and his old bosses, his old church and Bible study group, to tell them that God demanded the freedom of God's people. And through Moses' leadership and God's working, the people were able to be let go. God plagued Egypt, as the story goes, and God passed over the oppressed in Egypt as God struck down the firstborn of the powerful. And that final act allowed the people to leave Egypt, to walk right out of their oppression, walk right out of slavery, even cross the Red Sea on dry ground. And as God parted the water for them and literally liberated them from bondage, they were hungry and God gave them bread from the sky. But even in the midst of all of these miracles, even in the midst of their liberation, we meet them today on this journey of liberation and oppression and liberation and salvation and liberation and provision and liberation and fear. They quarrel against Moses. And they quarrel against God. They lament in their oppression and pain, in their fear. And they grumble against God. And Moses, trying to be their faithful leader, committed to being a non-anxious presence and a differentiated self, is beginning to lose his cool. The people, even though they've just experienced the promises of God and actual liberation, the miracle of God placing their feet on dry ground in the midst of a sea and sending bread from heaven, they still raise up this question to Moses. "Hey, Moses, why did you bring us out of Egypt just to kill us?" Put earlier in the text, "Hey, Moses, were there no graves in Egypt that you wanted us to die here in the wilderness?" You gotta imagine, right? Did these questions sting Moses? He's probably thirsty and hungry too, carrying their burdens and their pain, staying up late to counsel the elders, and they ask him, "Hey, you liberated us just to kill us, right?" They're inundated by death. All they see is death. Even as they journey through their liberation, they are still deeply afraid of death. Death in slavery and death in recaptivity and death by drowning and death by hunger and death by heat and now death by thirst. Death is all around them. So much so that they would rather return to slavery, return to Egypt, and go back to their captors. Unless you think the Israelites are all of that different from us, many of us have, as my friend Austin Almagayer says, a back to Egypt mentality too. You broke up with him for good reason, but you keep going back, not trusting your gut, and instead trying to save face for your family who wants you to be married by this age, a back to Egypt mindset. You write that letter of resignation for your job. You print out the letter and you begin to walk down the hall to your boss's office, but you turn around because the benefits are too good. You stay in that marriage, even though it doesn't feed you and it's not loving anymore. You keep letting your family say mean things about gay folk as if they aren't talking about you. You're committed to progressive values, but you work for an organization that's trying to build a wall, that's gambling on people's mortgages, that's providing the legal framework to ensure that kids are still sent directly to prison if they go to a bad school. Many of us are like the Hebrews. We vacillate between our desire for liberation and our devotion to the empire. Many of us are like the Hebrews who are trapped in this moral quagmire of wanting to be free and working for freedom on Sundays and Sundays believing in it, but then also longing for the security and the luxury and the accommodations that the empire provides. Y'all do know that's the real dilemma here, right? They aren't wrong about their hunger or their thirst or their fear. They're really experienced these things. And these people have been in slavery for years now, and their bondage is real. But even with the memory of slavery, they struggle because they cannot imagine what freedom looks like. They do not know what beloved ...ness really means. And so on their daily journeys, they walk, but they also waver. They groan, and they think life may have been actually better in Egypt. And they're not lying or being delusional, because life may have actually been better in Egypt than it actually is for them in the wilderness. And that's at the heart of the question that they ask Moses. Moses, is God not among us? In a real sense, they're asking Moses, life was tough in slavery. Life was tough in bondage, but at least we had food. At least we had water. At least we had variety in what we ate, and spices and meats and veggie and salmon and tacos and burgers and wine and whiskey and couches and bed. We have none of that here in the desert. Damn, send me back to oppression. If this is what liberation looks like, barrenness in the midst of a wilderness, I don't want it. Are y'all with me? This is the question they're really posing Moses. This is the reason they keep asking Moses and groaning and complaining against Moses, even after they walk across the land, even after they get bread from heaven, even after he provides water in this story, still more questions are coming. Because at the core of it, they doubt that liberation is possible. Is liberation possible? I want to argue to you that's the question of the Bible and the church. Is liberation really possible? Is God really among us? Is there a God who created the universe, who flung the stars into being, and who cares about little old me? Is there more to this life than working and sleeping and dying? Is there more to this family than food and money? Is there more to this job than showing up and clocking in and clocking out? Is it possible to live freely and beautifully and boldly and deeply in this body, in this black body, in this gay body, in this trans body, in this immigrant body? Can I actually be free? These are the questions that the whole congregation of Israel takes to Moses. These are questions of ultimate concerns, questions of liberation, questions of the nature and the essence of God. And the argument of the Bible is that, yes, liberation is possible, but it is not easy, and that is what the wilderness symbolizes. Liberation is disruptive and radical. It is lonely and unpleasant. It is painful and causes hunger and thirst. But its challenges do not mean that it is not better for us. Its challenges do not mean that it is not even necessary for us. The way the Israelites will ultimately come to see the necessity of their liberation will be once they can experience the abundance of life that liberation offers, once they can imagine and see that liberation, and once they can grieve about the difficulties of their life in Egypt. Walter Brueggemann put it this way: the dismantling of the empire begins once the people are able to grieve against it. He says, in the empire wants you to pretend that everything is okay. So you end up staying in the empire and looking only to the empire for help. But prophetic criticism and prophetic imagination is about getting people to see and understand their restless grief and nurturing them away from cry hearers who are inept at listening and indifferent to suffering and towards the one who can truly help. Grief, he argues, is a vehicle for imagination, and grief and imagination are essential for liberation. Imagination helps the people to move from thinking about the logistics of their pain to the certainty of their freedom. Imagination helps them to evoke an alternate reality, a beloved community, a new language and new structures, new realities. Our hymnist was on to something. New liturgies and new practices and scurns to see the God who serves as the ground and umbrella for all that it is and is uncoopted and uncontained by the empire. See, the people struggle because their grief and their imagination need to be tended to, and Moses, with all of his problems, is a tremendous leader because he's committed to sitting with the people and cultivating that grief and imagination. My brothers and my sisters, my family of God, what grieves you? What grieves you? What grieves you? What has the empire done to you? To your loved ones, to your neighbors, to your sense of self and self-worth, to your hope and your inspiration, your faith. What grieves you? Also, what can you imagine? Can you imagine your grief ending? Can you imagine the systems that oppress you toppling? Can you imagine your family quit being racist and homophobic? Can you imagine your nation ending its cold-hearted ICE raids? Can you imagine your nation ending its uncompassionate criminal proceedings? Can you imagine a world where the president isn't more powerful than the prophets, where the teen doesn't judge her worth by her clothes or how boys respond to her? Can you imagine a world where Black Lives Matter and where immigrants are welcome and where women are paid equally, and where labor isn't exploited, and where sexuality isn't controlled, and where identity isn't policed, and where freedom isn't limited, and where segregation isn't de facto, and where death is even though? Can you imagine this world? Can you imagine a world where bread comes from heaven and dry ground is made out the sea, and the lion and the lamb lie down to each other, and weeping and mourning are no more, and death has lost its victory, and a grave has no sting? Can you imagine that world? My brothers and my sisters, my family, my prayer is that we can grieve for the world as it is and imagine the world as it should be. That is the faith of the Bible. That is the faith that we are trying to cultivate as a whole congregation. And that is the promise of our God. That liberation is indeed possible. That justice will roll down like waters. That God will go with us as a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. But God won't force us. God will not force us to grieve the injustices of the empire, nor will God force us to imagine a better society. For that is the work of us and our leaders. That is the work of Moses and Miriam and Hagar and Mary. And contrary to what evangelicals say, that is the true work of Jesus, to imagine a better society, to show us that liberation is possible. And that if we choose it, if we pursue it, if we devote our lives to it and daily walk into the wilderness, making this radical and courageous and often frightening choice to leave the comforts of the empire and follow Moses and Jesus and all of the ancestors into the wilderness of liberation, that is where we'll meet God. That is how we will build a beloved community. That is how we will save this world from pending doom. If a few followers of Jesus and Moses and the other prophets to go into the wilderness deciding to follow Moses. I've decided to follow Moses. And my prayer is that our whole congregation and as much of the Christian church as possible would follow Moses too. I have decided to follow Moses. No turning back. No turning back. The cross before me. The world behind me. The cross before me. The world behind me. The cross before me. The world behind me, no turning back, no turning back. Though none go with me, I still will follow. Though none go with me, I still will follow. Though none go with me, I still will follow. No turning back. No turning back.